Hey everyone, welcome back to Dispatch Live. I'm Will Reinhardt. I'm the author of Techne, and today we are starting this off with a panel on tech and tech issues. The last week has been absolutely insane, or last week was absolutely insane. I'm tired. I'm actually quite tired. I don't know about you, Alex, but today to talk through this, I've got Alex Reinauer, the research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he, like myself, I know you do kind of a whole bunch of different tech issues and a whole bunch of things have been going on. So I thought I'd bring you on to kind of talk through really 3 days, three different issues. And hopefully if we can kind of work through these kind of quickly, we can get through kind of an insane week. So last Tuesday, Federal Trade Commission adopts this, what's now known or is now being called generally the non-compete rule. And this is kind of been in the works for a little while, right? I think it's now been on the docket for about a year or so. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but I think it was at the end of last year that we really started talking about this. So yeah, Alex, first off, thanks for coming on and tell me a little bit about non-competes. Tell me about like what's going on here. Just give me like the real basic lay of the land.
Yeah, well, non-compete agreements, as their name implies, are agreements not to compete with certain businesses. Typically, they're limited by a certain geographical area and a time, usually within 2 years. You can distinguish like non-competes that are associated with the sale of business. The FTC made pretty clear in their, I guess, when they announced the rule last year, that those weren't going to apply. And that's like to protect business goodwill. You don't want someone to sell a business and then solicit all the former customers from the business you just sold, right?
Yeah,
so there's no real fear of those. But employee non-competes, right, are typically an employee signs it. Oftentimes, states will require a certain like consideration or extra compensation for its enforcement. And there's about like 30 million employees in the U.S. that are currently covered under one. And this is a sweeping rule.
Yeah, yeah. How many people, like, what are the industries? Is this kind of like all over all these different industries? Is there one? You know, when I hear about this a lot, I hear people basically talking about, you know, especially like, you know, Jimmy John's employees or McDonald's employees who then can't go and work for, you know, another fast food restaurant. Is that what's going on here? Is this, you know, non-competes to me, when I hear it, I think of that. But then again, I'm also kind of in this world is, like when we're looking at the entire kind of like constellation of things going on here with non-competes, where are they typically located? What industries? Do we have good data on that? Like, it feels to me like this, you know, I keep on asking these questions and I've been asking these questions about tech for all of these years. And sometimes you get to this space where you're actually regulating something and we just generally don't even know too much about the industry. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and which industries you think will be affected by it.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but they're in a variety of different industries. Yeah. And as you mentioned, sometimes they're seen in the fast food industry. And with those particular non-competes, typically under the law, they're not enforceable, right?
Yeah.
Like a court is not going to enforce a non-compete from a former Jimmy John's employee. The problem is that the mere existence of the non-compete can create hesitation for an employee to ultimately like, get another job, right? So if there's like a judicial efficiency argument there, and also just the appearance, the existence of it will stop. Where they're really important, where they'll have the most negative effect, are on kind of like senior executives as well as just high earning employees. For instance, like Massachusetts has that consideration requirement, and there's like a huge biomedical research industry in Massachusetts. So the real problem with this, looking at retrospectively at non-competes that are already in place, oftentimes an employee gets, you know, really lucrative stock options or severance pay. So it's going to be interesting to see how courts are going to disentangle a non-compete that's now invalidated with all this other kind of compensation that's been associated with it in a contract.
Because because you bundle or you're negotiating for all these things together, and it's like, oh yeah, yeah. So and you're just like pulling apart whatever that contract negotiation bundle is, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And oftentimes when an employee gets a promotion, that's when the non-compete comes in, and then that's also associated with that kind of lucrative stock deal, right?
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Some of these, you know, high level executives or just really high paid employees, you know, they get an 18-month non-compete, and they go on vacation for a year and a half. Like that's the kind of serious compensation they're getting on the front end.
Yeah, seriously. Because I've seen some of these guys where it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, I'm going to go and do like a retreat, right? You know, I just got bought out. I'm going to go do this retreat. So that's wild. I didn't even think about that. That's the reason why they're taking that time off, is because during that time period, they can't do anything effectively, right?
Some of them become like real estate agents for a little bit. They get their real estate license and they sell some houses for fun. But yeah, sometimes they just enjoy the fruits of their labor and kind of relax for a little bit.
That's great. That's great. So why was the FTC wanting to do this?
I imagine part of it is from a structural standpoint. They kind of want to exercise their muscle and see what they can do with their rulemaking authority, right? Everyone's talking about Section 6G of the FTC Act. Which, you know, the FTC relies on very brief provisions of the FTC Act for this authority. So there's a pretty wide consensus that this is, I mean, we've already seen multiple lawsuits filed to challenge the rule. And I think it's more than likely that it's going to be struck down.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you saw Dan Crane, but he's been doing, I think, some interesting work going through and talking with folks. And he kind of like gives people, he's been doing this with all these recent actions at the FTC with the big court cases, but he'll go and, you know, he sends a bunch of emails out to folks who work in the industry and basically ask them like, where do you think that this is going to land? And the most recent one that he did on non-competes basically effectively suggested that very few people, basically no one thought that this only one, I think only one person from his, you know, survey. And again, it's not like a best survey, but he sends it out to attorneys who are, you know, practitioners, people who know this pretty well. His suggestion, at least that piece, really suggested that the law is not here, that it's not particularly well developed, or that rather the FTC doesn't have the jurisdiction to go after that. So, I mean, you said these court cases are likely to come. I would assume probably the chamber and some other groups are probably pulling together or pushing back against it. Broadly speaking, when we're talking about these court cases, what are they going to be going after? Is it just is it because the agency doesn't have authority, or is it something more than that?
Well, I think the chamber suit casts a pretty wide net, right? There's some arbitrary and capricious arguments. The major questions doctrine might be touched on a little bit, but
could you speak on major questions just real broadly, right? What does this do as compared to, I mean, because you and I know this, but to the audience, I mean, this is something that's new and major and it's really part of administrative law, but broadly speaking, what is the major questions doctrine? What has it changed in the last couple of years?
Yeah, well, it's founded right in the kind of separation of powers that, you know, Congress has legislative authority. They can delegate to a certain extent legislative authority to administrative agencies. But when they do so, and when they do with, you know, that has its vast economic importance, there has to be an intelligible principle. There has to be, you know, lined out what exactly is authority they're going to give. And so in this particular instance, right, it's just the power to make rules to carry out the act. And then there's a ban on unfair methods of competition. It's just two sentences. So it's clear there's not really an intelligible principle in this particular instance. And there's been, recent movement. There's a West Virginia case, right, where it seems that we have a lot of justices that are very sympathetic to the major questions doctrine. So I imagine that they'll be eager to use it if it ultimately reaches the Supreme Court, which it may not.
Yeah. And that's this is kind of an interesting thing. I was actually asking somebody about this recently, if they could give me, you know, not to say that you should do it, but I've been wanting to see something that is relatively short, you know, maybe 10 pages on what's generally happened over the last 4 to 5 years, administrative law, because the Supreme Court itself has gone and really made it, not made it harder, but it's made it harder substantively to go after or to promulgate some rules, to promulgate some regulatory structures. But it seems to me there's been a pretty big sea change over these last couple of years. And the major questions doctrine is one of them, right? It's kind of this newish doctrine that's being supported by the Supreme Court that if it relates to major questions, you know, there has to be effectively direct authority given to the agency itself. And this looks like one of those instances where there was not clear, kind of as you were saying, there was not clear authority that was given to the agency to do these things.
Yeah, I think there's overwhelmingly strong arguments that this rulemaking authority that the FTC is relying on are for procedural rules, right? housekeeping rules that allow them to, you know, facilitate kind of their adjudicative function, not a rulemaking authority that has, you know, legislative power that would essentially make the FTC like this mini legislature.
Interesting. Well, that actually is kind of a good segue. I mean, speaking of the legislature, you know, so this is on Tuesday, right? FTC adopts this non-compete rule. On Wednesday, we had the legislature, on Wednesday, Biden signs this formal TikTok ban, which came from the legislature and came from the Ukraine deal. It was a section within the Ukraine deal. I've written a little bit about this on the past. I know you've been thinking about these issues broadly speaking. What do you think is going to happen here? Do you think that TikTok, you know, and so this bill, for those who haven't been following this like incredibly in depth, basically demands that TikTok divest, or if it does not divest, then it's going to face a ban. It has, I believe, 9 months to divest of ByteDance. You know, so TikTok is currently owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. You know, this bill effectively requires a divestment from that structure within 9 months, and it gives the president a little bit longer. But do you think that TikTok is going to divest, or you know, where are we going to see this? Is it what happens next with this bill? Because, you know, to me, it's pretty important, but it seems as though there's people are unsure. At least some folks are unsure about exactly what the next step is for the company.
Yeah, well, I think you're being a little modest about it. You may have written a little bit about it, but you've done some really great work on it.
I appreciate it, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess it's hard to tell, right? I think TikTok has said that they're not going to sell, but I mean, I think there's been discussions of like Oracle or Microsoft coming in. And if they make a deal that, you know, they can't pass, they might divest. They have said that they're going to challenge it in court. I think I'm a little less optimistic about TikTok itself challenging it under kind of First Amendment grounds.
Could you lay that out a little bit? I mean, I know this is kind of TikTok versus the audience question, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm relying, I think, on smarter people than myself on this, but it seems like the users and kind of the users' rights to choose the platform that they want, regardless of whether or not it's a foreign owned platform or not. Have First Amendment interest in deciding where they receive information. And there's some like past court law, case law on this, right? About certain like levels, what right do we have to consume propaganda if we decide to do
which we do. We actually have the right to consume propaganda. And we actually, in fact, have the right to consume Chinese propaganda. Kind of a famous court case, that was all about limitations on, this is Lamont v. Postmaster. Mm-hmm. And basically, this is 1950s, early 1950s, the Postmaster would hold back material. It was actually at that time, the Peking Daily, now is the Beijing Daily. It was legitimately and is currently the propaganda arm of the Chinese Communist Party. And Postmaster said was, if you wanted this material, you had to go down to your post office in order to get, you know, in order to get it. And this is a rule that was pushed in the 1950s, and that was struck down by the Supreme Court and kind of started this newer, what we call like, you know, more, I don't want to say more aggressive, but it's much more firm, more modern sense of First Amendment law as compared to what had existed beforehand. But to me, this, you know, I know it's a bit of a leading question, and I have written some on this, and it seems to me that this problem, I mean, this will go to the courts. It doesn't feel like a slam dunk, but you know, it would be a very, very dramatic change of pace and dramatic change of First Amendment law if substantive parts of this bill were not struck down. Because, you know, there's this divestiture part, but then the question of the ban and how you actually implement the ban, I think is probably, to me, is among the most interesting parts of all of this, which it basically says it goes to Google and it goes to Apple and, you know, to other internet service providers. And they say that you cannot give or grant access to TikTok, you know, the website itself. You can't grant access to the application, right? All of these things are kind of stacked in there. And that, to me, you know, there's this one interesting question about the users, and then there's then another also interesting question about whether or not these other platforms, if ISPs and you know, Apple and Google and basically all the infrastructure in the internet, if they then also have the right to, or the First Amendment right to basically determine what goes over their pipes or goes over their platform. So there's so many layers to this with the TikTok question. I know a lot of people are really, really ginned up about it. And I don't know, the thing that worries me, and maybe I'm being way too pessimistic, but it seems like this older era of internet this older era of the open internet, the era that kind of built it, you know, this West Coast mentality of, you know, information needs to be free, you know, that entire mentality seems to be, I don't want to say dying, but the conversation is splitting the entire scope of the conversation over First Amendment rights on the internet is just, it's just fundamentally changing in a way that, you know, we had not too long ago, we had the Arab Spring, you know, that was about 10 years ago at this point. And now I feel like we're having this complete opposite conversation about what we need to be doing with the, you know, with the internet, with these platforms, with TikTok, with content that is potentially nefarious, which, you know, I'll leave those questions because that's something we could also get into. But what are you thinking, broadly speaking, about this, you know, this idea of the splinternet or this era, this kind of closing of the open internet? Do you think, you know, am I making too much hay of this? Is this just not really like, is TikTok kind of like one of these one-off issues? Or do you see this broader conversational shift within First Amendment issues as it relates to the internet?
Yeah, well, the splinternet thing is interesting. And I think there's a way to think of it almost like an international trade way, right? About kind of free trade of information, right? And there's books on this about the kind of peace that's created by trade. And you know, I'd like to be optimistic and think that, you know, some kind of armed conflict with China is not inevitable. And I think I'd like to keep that kind of optimistic view.
Yeah.
But this certainly doesn't help to kind of lead to some long-term sustainability, a sustainable relationship with China, which is still one of our biggest trade partners. Again, I like to be optimistic, but there's a lot to worry about.
Yeah. And I guess that also then kind of gets into the last related issue. Thursday, we saw my favorite issue come up yet again. And this is when the FCC formally adopted the latest network neutrality rules. Man, oh man, network neutrality. I don't even know what to say about this issue. You know, when I was writing out notes for this, and I think I sent it to you, and I asked just this simple question, this again, right? Like, is there anything new here that we should be worried about or that we should be thinking about? You know, so quickly, could you tell us just what network neutrality is and what is it that this version of the rule, is this version of the rule any different than what we've seen over the last couple years? Or what is this issue? Why is it kind of coming up to the forefront yet again?
Yeah, I think those are difficult questions, and I think you're far more experienced on this than I am. I'm not the go-to telecom guy. What I really like to look at is kind of just the facts that have surrounded, right? Because it seems like we have data as to whether or not, when this was in place before, did it work? And after it was removed, did things get better? And it seems that there's some significant data there, right? That during net neutrality, the internet speeds slowed. And then once it was removed, internet speeds increased. So it doesn't seem like there's an actual like policy problem that it's actually seeking to solve.
Yeah. And I think that even kind of walking around some of the network neutrality questions to me is, it seems kind of network neutrality. So I have been working on this pretty much my entire career, and it's probably one of those, it's unfortunately one of those topics that just comes up over and over and over and over again. You know, I will say, so broadly speaking, it's this, network neutrality is this idea that internet service providers shouldn't slow down or speed up content, broadly speaking, right? That's this kind of like pie in the sky notion. I think what's interesting and what's been happening here is that, you know, network neutrality is this issue that was first kind of conceptualized in 2005. Then we had a version of it in 2010. We had another version of it in 2014, and then, you know, 2018, the end of 2018. So some of these dates are a little fuzzy because a lot of them came at the very, very end of a year and the beginning of the next year. And so when it was actually adopted as compared to the rules, a lot of them actually kind of split the years. But needless to say, this to me has been one of those topic areas that You know, we talked a little bit about major questions doctrine, whether or not the agency itself will have the ability to promulgate, to push the rules. And this is yet another one of those areas. This, in fact, is, from my understanding, this could be a very important series of court cases that comes from this network neutrality rule that we're seeing. You know, and primarily because of this, because it was the precipitating factor, this kind of back and forth over many years. The agency never really had power. They kept on pushing the rules. And this is something that Kavanaugh, I believe, has been working in over the last couple of years, is thinking through this problem in the administrative state. This is Justice Kavanaugh. And it seems that there could be something that's going to happen here that could change administrative law. And I know this is kind of like wonky, but it seems to me that what's been happening within tech in the last three days, right? Last Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, there's a lot of action that's been happening behind the scenes, and it's stuff that most people aren't paying attention to. Now, I know a lot of people have heard about the TikTok ban, but at the end of the day, this comes down to whether or not it's legal, and FTC non-compete rule, probably not legal, probably don't have administrative authority. You know, the TikTok
ban, I think it's much more clear for the non-compete than net neutrality. But because it's Title II of the Federal Communications Act.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And that was designed for like copper wire telephones. It was never intended to apply to internet service providers.
Yeah, yeah. This is back into the night. Yeah, and you're exactly right. And this determination was started under, Computer Inquiries 1 and 2, which were from like 1976. They started making this distinction. And then when the entire Telecommunications Act was rewritten in 1996, they did this other sort of separation to me. It's really fascinating. It's really, really, really fascinating to see this shift over time. I don't know about the FCC. I also wonder if the FCC has been adopting the network neutrality rules to keep relevant, right? There's not been a lot of action that's been happening within the agency. The FTC, things have shifted much more in the internet computer landscape towards, you know, privacy and First Amendment issues privacy, First Amendment issues, antitrust even more so. And it feels like to me, the FCC adopting the latest network neutrality rules is one of those things that it's trying to do in order to keep relevant in this space. I know this is something they want to do. Yeah, but I'm yeah, sorry. Yes, go ahead.
And I think the FTC and the FCC signed some kind of memorandum of understanding today. I haven't read it yet, but it was on net neutrality. So it looks like there's going to be continued agency cooperation between the FTC and the FCC.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. What do you expect? Do you think that court case, do you have any sense of who might bring that court case? Do we know who's going to bring that court case or, you know, what?
Not sure.
Not sure. Okay. I guess this is all super fresh. This is really, I mean, this was last Thursday, right? This is not been all that long ago. I know it feels these weeks feel very, very, very long because so much is happening.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you're working on right now that people should be aware of that? I know we may have some questions. I know we may have some questions from folks, but what are you currently working on while I look through these questions and try to formulate something that may be cogent?
Yeah, well, one thing I'm looking at again is the One Agency Act, which is back in Congress. It's a really kind of big overarching reform bill that would remove the antitrust power of the FTC and place it solely with the Department of Justice. You know, we have two agencies that do antitrust. The FTC kind of has this internal adjudication, its own court, where it investigates, it prosecutes. And ultimately makes a decision, right? I mean, real big questions of separation of powers. And there's court cases currently going through the circuits right now that are challenging that. So this would just kind of be a clean way to place it with the DOJ, which is better equipped, historically has been better at litigating cases in Article III courts. I'm not optimistic, again, that it's going to pass, but I think it is it's a good bill and it deserves some attention.
Yeah. So yeah, this is another sleeper issue that I feel like people who work on tech policy care a lot about just because of the things that are happening at the agency level. And I think that we worry a lot about administrative law in a weird sort of way. Real quick question from from Jonathan Strickland, and then we'll wrap up here. This one is not at all controversial. What relevance does the SCOTUS holding that foreign entities not having First Amendment rights play here? Do Americans' First Amendment rights require us to allow any foreign entity to do anything? I don't know if you want to comment on that a little bit, and then I can also take that as well.
Yeah, well, I think if that's likely going to play a role in whether or not TikTok will have, or ByteDance will have success on the court level. And I think that's probably why users will have a better chance. And I don't necessarily think that that holding is going to affect users' rights and their First Amendments. But
yeah, more to say on it. Well, I think that this, the other part of here that probably is something that we assume and we kind of know about this law and these court cases, which most people may not be aware of, there's basically I don't want to say threshold levels because I don't know that that's the right term. But when you actually look at the kinds of things that are, when you look at constitutionality, it kind of like, it jumps up in importance. So when we're talking about communication and free speech issues and issues of communication, they just grant and are granted a lot more First Amendment and constitutional scrutiny as compared to a lot of other things, right? And there's the ability to, you know, we have a whole bunch of foreign limitations on, you know, dual use technologies. All that stuff has really done, you know, has survived court muster. There's been a lot of these court cases that have gone through, broadly speaking, on limitations on trade. Now, when it comes to First Amendment, it's just a different world. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are trying to conflate the two and say that this is just a trade issue. But to me, fundamentally, we're talking about 170 million American users for TikTok. And that, to me, is just, it's driving this conversation. And it's going to be driving the conversation because it's a constitutional issue in a way that, you know, saying that we can't interact with certain kinds of people who are making or, you know, are mining certain materials. You know, those sorts of issues and industries are just separate. And I think they should be separate, right? We should give First Amendment concerns a lot more interest and a lot more scrutiny than the kind of trade concerns that we probably should defer. You know, they still have constitutional scrutiny, but it's at a lower threshold. And I'm mm-hmm. you know, I'm kind of okay with the way the constitutional law so far has really shaken out. But anyway, yes, thank you very much for taking the time. I know we went a little bit over, but Alex, thank you. I'd love to bring you on in the future. If people think it was a good conversation, let us know. Quickly, where can people find you?
I'm on X. I'm on formerly known as Twitter.
There we go.
I don't think I remember my Twitter handle, but there's very few Alex Reinhours out there. So
lovely. And I'm Will Reinhardt. I'm also on Twitter. And now we're going to switch over to Kevin, who is going to be talking with, I'm sorry, I didn't see the other co-host because I'm horrible and I didn't do all of the requisite back-end work to make a smooth transition, but thanks for listening to us rant about tech issues for the last, I guess, 28 minutes.
Nerds. All right. I'm Kevin Williamson. I'm a national correspondent for the Dispatch, and I'm here with Mark Tooley of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, who is here to talk about a question that has been asked with decreasing frequency for 60 years. What's going on with the Methodists?
Well, a lot is going on with the Methodists. They used to be the biggest church in America. For most of the 20th century, they were the biggest Protestant church in America. For the last 60 years, they've been the third largest religious body in America after Catholics and Southern Baptists. And they're quickly moving down the ladder. They just were shattered in a schism that concluded mostly last year with about 25% of the conservative churches exiting the denomination. And right now, its governing general conference is meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, where progressives are pretty much sweeping the table, which will further discourage remaining conservatives and non-progressives and will probably lead to the ongoing meltdown of what used to be called America's church.
Yeah. And well, part of what's going on here, of course, is that it's not America's church anymore, that the American conservatives have left, but there are a lot of conservatives overseas, particularly in Africa, who are still part of the Methodist church, but they don't have the numbers without the support of the American churches that have left already. And so they're about to get strong-armed at the convention, right?
Well, they are. It's very sad that the Africans actually are a majority of the global denomination's members, and the Africans are very conservative in their theology and in their ethics. And so if there were fair representation, they would be sweeping the votes by about 60%. But they only get a third of the votes, and a quarter of them couldn't even get visas to come to the U.S. So they have about 25% of the delegates. And so there's, with that, with the American conservatives largely gone, the Africans are pretty isolated, and I think ultimately will leave the denomination.
So what's at the root of the controversy here? Is it all about homosexuality, or are there other things at play as well?
Sexuality has been the key public battle flag issue dividing traditionalists and progressives for the last 50 years. It's been fought out at every one of these conventions every 4 years since 1972. But obviously, that's just the surface issue. Key differences over the Bible, over Christology, over salvation, over what the church is. Is the church supposed to convert people, or is it supposed to affirm people? And these differences ultimately were irreconcilable.
So, but it's not just, you know, issues of, say, you know, gay people and such. As I understand it, there was a question about adultery and removing adultery as from the list of offenses that clergy could be disciplined for.
Yes, many people after this Methodist convention are going to be surprised by just how radicalized it is on these sexual ethics issues. So something called, quote unquote, the simple plan is sweeping through the conference, removing all restrictions on consensual sexual activity. So previously, the church required that clergy had to be celibate if single and monogamous in male-female marriage, and you could be brought up on charges and perhaps potentially defrocked if you were in violation. All of that is being removed.
Yeah, the Methodists seem to me to be an interesting reflection of what happened with progressivism more broadly from the early 20th century into our time, really in the last century, where the Methodists in the early part of the 20th century, even in the late 19th century, were very, very socially conservative, but also very politically progressive on some things. They were the people who, you know, had a really strict sense of sexual ethics, and a lot of them were behind things like prohibition, but they also were champions of things like women's suffrage and civil rights. It was a big enough church that George W. Bush was a Methodist growing up, and Hillary Rodham Clinton was a Methodist growing up, two very politically different people, and who were all there in that Big Ten. I was raised in the Methodist church myself, to the extent that I was raised in church. And they kept the political activism, but seemed to have dropped the moral conservatism. And that seems to be something that happened more broadly throughout the progressive movement. It hasn't just been the churches.
Well, that's very perceptive and very correct. And many Methodists were, as you say, politically progressive, but still personally and ethically very traditional sexuality, on alcohol, on a whole range of issues, but always social reformers, always trying to improve society. Every great social reform movement in the 19th and 20th century has some kind of Methodist connection. Prohibition was basically, Methodism was its father, and arguably Methodism's social and political influence that peaked and never quite recovered after the overthrow of Prohibition. But yes, usually Methodist progressives still held to very traditional ethics, but that's been quickly transforming over the last 40 years.
You know, there's a bit of an irony here in that the Methodists broke off from the Anglicans in the, I guess, in the 18th century, the very end of the 18th century. And they're going through essentially what the Anglicans and the Episcopalians went through 20 or 25 years ago, where you've got differences over theology, particularly sexual ethics, division in the church, and you know, questions about property and church organization, and a very conservative element of overseas churches, particularly in Africa, that are not down with the kind of American social radical agenda. And in the case of the Anglicans, as you probably know, what happened was a lot of the more American, conservative American parishes ended up essentially transferring themselves to be put under African bishops that were more morally and socially and theologically close to where they were. In the case of the Methodist Church, the American churches have really just, you know, split out and they're doing their own thing now. Do we think that these African churches are going to stay in the Methodist Church, or are they going to be leaving the communion as well?
Well, the Africans in the denomination will be pondering that after this General Conference when they see how sweeping these changes are. But you know, the African Church came out of nowhere and has grown to millions of members, such that it outnumbers the U.S. Church. So it's vibrant. It's very vital. And it's the only reason the American conservatives had been winning on sexuality for the last 20 years, when all of the other mainline Protestant denominations had liberalized on sexuality 20 and 15 years ago. So the Africans have a decision to make. But I think in 5 years, the United Methodist Church will probably be a denomination of a couple of million American members, and that will be it.
How many American Methodists are there now?
Well, the last official count in 2022 was 5.7, but at least 1.5 million left in the schism, plus the natural attrition of several hundred thousand a year. It's probably down to about 4 million. And again, it was 11 million in 1968.
So sort of Houston, essentially, about.
Yes, and the Methodists used to be equal in size to the Southern Baptist Convention in the 1960s, and now the Southern Baptists are 13 million, and the Methodists are about, in the U.S., about 4 million.
Do you think democracy is a good way to solve these disputes? I know a number of churches have gone through these things. There are certain in the Presbyterian world, in the Methodist world, in the Anglican world, there have been these, essentially political contests. As a Catholic, I take a more imperialistic and monarchical view of these things. And we have committee meetings that last for 600 years, and that's how we sort these things out. But is this something that should be voted on? Is that the right way to do this?
Well, this is how Protestants function, of course. But I think if this general conference and if the denomination were more democratic, and if the Africans actually had fair representation, and if the American lay people actually were better represented and it weren't so dominated by the clergy and the institutionalist and the bureaucracy, we would be in a very, very different situation.
So is this essentially a repeat of the story we've seen it? Millions of other or thousands of other nonprofits, whether they're churches or other kinds of organizations, where they've essentially been captured by management. Because as I understand it, the leadership of the Methodist Church was really at odds with where the average Methodist in the pews was. And when these things went to, sort of popular votes, the congregations were against them, not in huge numbers, but the majority took a considerably more conservative stance. And so you've got a really radicalized leadership that is quite different from where the sort of rank and file are.
Absolutely true. Progressives solidified their control over the seminaries, not just for Methodists, but for all the mainline Protestants early in the 20th century. And then the church bureaucracies are radicalized in the 1960s, became much more political. So the laity stayed center-right. The clergy were mostly center-left. The bishops were further left, and the national church bureaucracy based in New York or Washington or wherever was farthest left.
Yeah. And this will sound like a Catholic chauvinist question, but I'll ask it anyway. Does it really matter if there are 8,551 Protestant denominations or 8,552?
Well, there are always going to be more and more and more. And that's the great bane and also the secret sauce of Protestantism. It's endlessly entrepreneurial and splitting off and spawning and planting new churches. And somehow it just churns along.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Read his piece, please, everyone, if you haven't looked at it. Hey, look, it's John McCormick and David Drucker.
Kevin, has anyone complimented you on your sweater yet?
No, but thank
well,
you.
Let me be the first to do it.
I assumed there was a compliment coming.
It's
may have asked. Well, there's a reason for that,
No, it's a genuine compliment, but it's you don't expect Kevin Williamson to have a Mr. Rogers fashion sensibility.
A little. It was either that or I was thinking Masterpiece Theater. I was thinking Masterpiece Theater.
And the tie and the cardigan has kind of been my thing for at home video, I think, because it's too weird to wear a suit, but if I wear a sweatshirt, I'm not cool like David. I look like an unmade bed, I look like just, you could put me in Marine dress uniform and I look like I'm wearing pajamas after 3 hours anyway. I'm just that kind of person. But I think maybe my fashion sense is not the subject we were here to talk about tonight.
Anyway, that is a shame.
Why not?
Someone wants to know if Kevin is in a 19th century British novel.
Yeah, I think the reader. Look at that. Look at these comments. This is obviously what the viewers want to talk about. They want to know where can we get
that. Smoking jackets are tied in the front and they're made of velvet. So this is not a smoking jacket. But all right, okay. No one talking about the big rack of guns in the back.
We can't see those. Yeah, I'd love to talk about those. So.
All right. Well, I'll put some.
I'm wearing my DC uniform of a blue shirt and khaki pants, which you know I loathe those kinds of center right types when I was 18, and now it's just easier. Life is just more simple when you wear this.
Yeah, if I wear a blue shirt and khaki pants, I look like a CVS manager. I just can't do it. Some people, people look great.
My new press pass too, fresh off the hill. So.
Oh, very nice. Very fancy.
It's yellow. I don't look very good in yellow. So.
Yeah. Middlemarch, by the way, is the novel that I'm in for the person who was asking. I was trying to think of which one would be the one I'm actually in. What the hell is going on at the RNC? Let's talk about something more worse than my fashion sense.
Well, we're not totally sure yet. You know, as we've talked about before, they fired everybody and then set about hiring a lot of them back. Most of the people that were let go were in the field department, about 40 people. And the hiring back has been slow. And so, as we reported in Dispatch Politics on Friday, Ronna McDaniel, before she was defenestrated from the committee by Donald Trump, had 40 field offices across the key battleground states ready to go. They were going to open, and the RNC was going to do what it at least has done since 2014, which is engage in a pretty robust voter turnout operation. All of that got delayed and put on hold while the new regime, which is Chris LaCivita, Michael Whatley is the chairman, LaCivita is Trump's senior advisor. And of course, Laura Trump is the co-chair of the RNC. I have to say, co-chairs at the RNC are generally forgettable and have no power. But because she's Trump's daughter-in-law, there's a lot of focus on her. So they've been trying to reimagine, that was my little aside there, but they've been trying to reimagine the ground game. They don't want to do what the RNC has done in 14, 16, 18, 20, and 22. And a lot of my sources believe one of the reasons they don't want to do that is because they don't have the resources or don't believe they'll have the resources. So I think we're likely to see something that's more tailored, that focuses particularly on Trump and only Trump, whereas usually the RNC will do some focus on down ballot races and even in some states where you have big House races or Senate races that are not presidential battlegrounds. So focused on Trump, narrowly tailored. And my sources are beginning to tell me that the RNC may farm out some of this to third party groups or outside groups and super PACs to the extent that is possible. And we're going to have to wait to see. They just really don't have much of a footprint right now in any of the states. No offices, no volunteers, no training, no voter reg. Trump's in a good position polling wise, and I expect the RNC will eventually field something, and it'll probably be, you know, at least somewhat substantial. You know, the question is if this is another dogfight like 2020, where these races in the key states are decided by 10,000 votes, 20,000 votes, anything less than 100,000 votes, that's where ground game can make a huge difference. And that's where Joe Biden, for all of his challenges, is doing quite well.
John, I wanted to ask you about a kind of parallel case that suggests itself to me, which is the Obama administration. So Barack Obama had a great presidency if your name was Barack Obama. But during those years, Democrats couldn't win an election basically anywhere else in the country. And it was an absolute bloodbath for them in Congress, the state level, the local level. We all know this story. At the end of those years, Republicans were in charge of 115 state governorships and 6,000 seats in the House and all 500 state legislatures and or whatever the numbers are. You didn't see the same kind of bloodbath in the Trump years, but you saw something similar in some ways where Republicans went into that in a really good position in the states and they're considerably weakened from then. It seems that the Republican Party as an apparatus is also considerably weakened. Part of this is just that the parties are getting weaker and less important, and a presidential candidate is now more important than his party and doesn't need his party for as much. But is this going to be a kind of alternating thing where you see a candidate who does well from a particular party and him doing well as a presidential candidate or being president ends up coinciding just regularly with the decline of his party everywhere else?
That's a tough question. Off the top of my head, I'm going to say it's going to depend on the sort of the demographic makeup of the coalition behind them. So with Obama, I mean, the irregular voters were young, African-American. They were the voters who showed up for the presidential but didn't show up for the midterms. With Trump, it's the more, you know, rural vote that is going to show up in the presidentials, but a non-college vote that's less likely to show up. That's an interesting question that, you know, the Republicans had during the Obama years. They had, they ramped the score with the, you know, white suburban voters. That meant that they could lose, you know, nationwide. What did Obama win the popular vote by in 2012? I forget. But, you know, Republicans still held the House, and that wasn't entirely because of it wasn't entirely because of gerrymandering. It had to do with the distribution of the vote, that Republicans were winning all these suburban districts, you know, 55-45 or 52-48, and, you know, Democrats were winning their urban districts, you know, 85-15. I'm making that up. I don't know exactly which district would have been that lopsided. And now you're seeing a similar thing where you're getting wasted, so-called wasted votes, where you're running up the score in a House district doesn't get you an extra House seat. Republicans are running up the score in, you know, deep red districts. They're losing ground in purple suburban districts. So I do think it's a weird way that Obama and Trump both had these coalitions that had a lot of people who are regular voters would show up for them, would show up in presidentials, and then were not the kind of people to show up in special elections, and less likely to show up in midterms.
I was engaged in a little question begging earlier where I sort of asserted without proving that party apparatus doesn't matter, or at least as much as it used to. Am I right about that? Am I wrong about that? The fact that the RNC seems to be in a state of chaos and disarray and has people named Trump in charge, which is never a good thing for an organization. Does it really matter?
Well, I think it matters. I mean, I think, you know, I like this analogy just because if you're a Nationals fan or if you're a Rangers fan, just because your pitching's bad doesn't mean pitching doesn't matter. The Democratic National Committee, which languished under Obama because he had no use for it or use for his party and did everything outside of the party. So during those years, the DNC languished. And the Republican National Committee was a very well-run committee during the Obama years and developed a data analytics program and a permanent voter turnout operation, functioned really well. And I think that these things still matter because the Biden campaign, the one thing it's doing really well and has an advantage on is infrastructure. And it's doing that in concert with the Democratic National Committee. And in fact, Joe Biden, the consummate party man, has been very good for the DNC. It's seen a resurgence of fundraising and impact under Joe Biden, whereas, you know, under Trump, it was hit or miss because Trump actually in 2016 relied on that permanent ground game and data analytics program stood up by Reince Priebus when he was chairman to be essentially his infrastructure in 2016. Trump didn't have one, didn't really understand it. The RNC did it. In 2020, Trump collaborated with the RNC and, you know, Trump didn't lose through any fault of the infrastructure. Where I would say, Kevin, you're right that parties matter less is ideologically, they're not enforcers. I mean, I joke all the time that parties have become sort of glorified ballot access organizations, right? So they've got the ballot line.
That's a really funny joke, by the way.
but they don't, you know, and so notwithstanding my comments about infrastructure, they don't police their own ranks. They don't police themselves ideologically. They don't moderate their own ranks. They're not able to be enforcers because they are not in full control of the money. And so they do matter a lot less. But on the infrastructure question, on the voter turnout question, they still can matter a great deal and often do.
Do we expect them to be less and less in charge of the money as the years go on?
Well, I don't know if they can be any less in charge, but they're just because ever since campaign finance reform put hard limits on what committees can raise and what candidates can raise. And in this democratized world of super PACs and online giving and social media platforms, hey, I just screamed at the person you hate, give me $5. They just simply don't have the ability to control it. And because they can't control it, they can't enforce, right? Because you cannot go to a candidate or an incumbent who's in office, who's misbehaving, and say, cut it out or you're getting no money, or we don't like you, you're bad for our party, you're getting no money. They can just go around you. So I don't know if it can get any worse, but it's not getting any better.
Yeah. Somewhere in my head, there's a put it out of its misery segue, which takes us to a question I have here in front of me, which is, does Kristi Noem have a shot, as someone put it in the notes, at being vice president, or the vice presidential nominee anyway?
I'd say 0.0, and I already thought they were about zero just based on her strong upper Midwestern accent. I'm from rural Wisconsin, but I just, you have to get into Trump's mindset and, you know, start judging people based on things like central casting. And I think that, yeah.
How many dogs have you murdered? I just want to know how many dogs you've murdered.
Me?
Well, you're from rural Wisconsin.
I actually have murdered dogs. I have a story. I'm not going to tell you if it's a happy or a sad story, but we had a farm dog. My family was on a farm. We moved to the town when I was a baby. And when I was about 4 years old and my sister was seven, we were riding our bicycles around the garage. Apparently, when you're that small, you can actually do circles in there and it seems big. My sister ran over our dog Bruiser's tail. Bruiser was an outdoor dog. Despite the name, he was very kind. He was about 12 years old, 14 years old, never harmed a soul. And he bit her very badly in the face. Had to go to the hospital, get stitches. And what that meant was he needed to be taken to the vet to be put down. And my older brother, he tried to spare Bruiser's life. He ransomed him with his piggy bank, fell on deaf ears. But when my dad took the dog to the vet just looked at him and said, this is once in 14 years, this dog's not going to hurt anybody. And Bruiser, his life was spared. He lived out the rest of his days in a doghouse. He was already an outdoor dog. He was a farm dog and then an outdoor dog. But he got to, you know, eat a little, basically the refuse of our family of six, from like soggy Cheerios to beef stroganoff and like one big slop pail at the end of the day. So he lived out his days fairly happy, if not very, not much interaction with the rest of the family the rest of his days. So anyway, yeah, I'm pretty appalled by Kristi Noem just shooting a puppy. There are ways to avoid that. Having grown up in a farm country, I never heard of anybody having to, and if they did put down their dog like that, they didn't tell anybody. They probably felt bad about it. They didn't write about it in a book. I don't think it's necessarily less humane. It's obviously more gruesome than a lethal injection. But
the hard thing about living on a farm is you can't tell your kids the dog went to go live on a farm.
That is true.
Okay, so you think she had zero chance based on her accent and other superficial features? See, and I hesitate even to say this because it's one of those things that can be misconstrued. But I think Trump makes decisions on superficial features as well. I think he's likely to want to pick a woman for his vice presidential nominee. And I think she's the best looking of them. And I think that would probably matter enormously to him. But who knows? That's just my view on it.
The Veep stakes do kind of require sexism by proxy. You know, that's just the nature of the business.
I'm kind of high on the Doug Burgum idea.
Really?
Because it's like Mike Pence, just somebody else. Mild-mannered, boring governor who is competent and will never outshine Trump.
Yeah, gosh. Burgum is smart. And I think that would make it hard for him to do the job.
Yeah, but it's certainly not going to stop him from wanting to do the job.
Well, okay. Do you think he wants to do the job? I mean, okay.
Yes, 100%.
You think so? So everybody who gets offered this sort of thing wants it.
Well, not only that. I mean, look, we interviewed Doug Burgum for a Dispatch podcast and spent a little time around him. Doug Burgum. Now, listen, he is a very successful businessman, made hundreds of millions of dollars. And a successful two-term governor of North Dakota. I don't know if it's hard to do, but you know, I haven't done it and I don't want to down talk it. You don't get to that level, Kevin, as you know, without having a real high opinion of yourself. And sometimes people get to that level, didn't deserve it, and they still have a high opinion of themselves. And he had such a high opinion of himself that even as a governor from North Dakota, which, you know, three people live there and nobody's ever heard of Doug Burgum, he still ran for president and was actually one of those people that was frustrated that he couldn't break through. Like, it bothered him that people with fewer qualifications were actually getting ahead.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that got ahead of him had fewer qualifications. His qualifications are good. So I can only imagine that one of the reasons he endorsed Trump right away, someone who he has nothing in common with whatsoever, other than they're both a member of the same party, was because he is eyeing the idea of being Mike Pence part due.
Man, I think that if I were thinking of a way to get punished for my sins, being Mike Pence part two would sound like a real likely way to do that. But I guess that sounds good to some people.
Well, you know how we say a poor man's this? He's a wealthy man's Mike Pence.
Yeah, I guess so. Huh. The other name I hear kicked around just a ton in these conversations is that of J.D. Vance. And what do we think about Vance as a candidate?
I think if he went with Vance, that would definitely mean that sort of the Tucker Carlson, Don Jr. had prevailed upon him. Vance, you know, he ran something like 20 points behind Mike DeWine. If you point this out, you know, the flying monkeys of the new right will come after you on Twitter saying it was all about abortion, even though Mike DeWine signed a heartbeat bill with no rape exception in it and cruised to re-election. So, you know, Vance, he actually, I mean, he is articulate. I mean, that was one thing you noticed. He was saying crazy things. He was running as a Marjorie Taylor Greene candidate in the primary. But when you, you know, just watching him on stage, he was the only person with a lick of rhetorical talent. So I don't know. I don't really see why he'd want to go that route. I doubt it. I think that J.D. Vance, you know, he did run to be, you know, it's weird because Trump is obviously, you know, he sort of unleashed his whole new right attempt to create a ideological framework around a cult of personality. But, you know, the Blake Masters and the Peter Thiel types and J.D. Vance have been weaker than Trump himself. It's weird that we say, you know, Trump, these Trumpy candidates bombed in 22. They did, but Trump himself obviously, you know, can't be, I don't know. Anyway, it's that I've gone on long enough. I think unlikely, but what do you think, David?
I think Vance is, I consider Vance to be on the short list of people that we should consider as serious picks. He's young. As Kevin reminded us, he's out of central casting. He's a Marine veteran. He's got all the credentials. He is sufficiently supportive
slavish,
of Trump. There you go. Okay. I mean, we hire, you know, the Dispatch brought you on to say stuff like that. They brought me on to say the other stuff. And he's the kind of pick that, you know, will excite the party. And given Trump is up there in years, even though it doesn't get as much attention as Joe Biden for reasons that are legitimate, it's a good contrast. And I firmly believe that Vance wants it. I think he'll run for president anyway, but
yeah,
you know, he wants it. So I would keep Vance on a short list.
Guys, quick reader question. One of our viewers wants to know if Biden made a mistake going on Howard Stern and saying he would debate Trump.
No, he has to debate Trump because otherwise the questions about his age will just be affirmed. I mean, they're affirmed for most people anyway. Also, one of the reasons Biden is president today is because of how horrible Trump was in that first debate that they had in the 2020 campaign. He should want to debate Trump. And it almost mystifies me that Trump is in such a hurry to debate Biden, considering how bad he was at debating Biden in 2020.
John?
I didn't know the answer to that question, but now having heard David's answer, I will say everything David said is correct, and I cannot improve upon it.
As usual, we'd all like to associate ourselves with David's remarks and amplify them and countersign them. That concludes it for us tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. We will see you next week. Thank you all for being part of our community. Please subscribe to The Dispatch if you haven't, and get other people subscribed to The Dispatch if you get a chance to. Buy them. Give subscriptions, twist arms, let people know. We're doing all sorts of fun, interesting, good stuff. These two guys are providing tremendous reporting and content. So sign on up, and we will see you next week.